What's interesting about the film as a whole, and indeed the play as a whole, is the way that Moore's focus on his vocation, which is justice, to be a lawyer, is completely integrated with his character. He's such a just man that he's never knocked off course, whatever the changes that he has to face, obviously going through a time of very, very difficult political change and pressures. And you see that in the little tiny things, the way he deals with Richard Rich, the way that he's completely just to the boatman. Every time he faces any situation, it's the integrity just goes through him. I mean, my image of a virtue is a stick of rock, you know, Blackpool Rock, and Blackpool's written right the way through it. In the same way, integrity is written right the way through him, justice is written right the way through him. So whatever he faces, he'll respond in the right way. So in order to be able to respond like that, we need to have our vocation and the virtues associated with that vocation, if you like, right the way through us. In a background of change, it might be a nice exercise just to sit back and jot down what you think are the really big changes in the world of healthcare, not in the last couple of years, not, you know, some shifting target, but in the last century. The sort of thing that Martin did so well for us with childbirth. Think about that on the grand scale in other areas as well. But one huge change, and this is the one I want to focus on, is the shift from simply a personal relationship to institutional and political context that threatens to swamp the personal relationship. So originally, in the ideal past, the main relationship, if not the only relationship, would be that between the patient and the person healing them, whether it was a doctor, a nurse, or a midwife. That personal relationship would be what it was all about. Now there's this great network, institutional, bureaucratic, political network of people to whom you're accountable in all sorts of different ways, the general public, the politicians, the healthcare trusts, whatever, and the people coming in and checking. And you're trying to preserve that personal relationship within all that. So the politics and the bureaucracy, they've led to a focus on micromanagement, very fast-paced change, sometimes that you can have no control, often you have no control over at all, or feel you don't. And they've led to a focus on procedures, basically because procedures are easy to check. You can tick them, you can list them, you can count them, you can reproduce statistics about them. And so there's a great pressure on the things that you can't count and check. That extra few minutes listening to a patient, the smile, the little bit of time. And there's also a pressure on your human and your personal judgments, because the best professional and personal judgments can't just be reduced to a tick list. Again, think about Thomas More and the way that he didn't just stick rigidly to the law when it came to being fair to the boatman. The law was there as a good principle, but because of his deep sense of justice, he knew when to go beyond it, when to be more flexible. And those are the things that it can be difficult to do. Hold on to that personal judgment, that personal time, space, gentleness, and so on, under pressure from the political and the bureaucratic pressures. Now, we can ask a lot of political questions, if we want to, about the whole system of accountability. And I think, actually, we're muddling together there in all sorts of areas, not just in health, a lot of different things, which it would be much better if we keep them separate and think about them separately. But that's another story, really. I just want to think now about this personal relationship. And in order to think about that, I think you have to keep really, really clear in mind what it is to have a vocation as I'm going to use the word healer, a Christian healer. I'm trying to think of a general word that brings in doctors, nurses, midwives, whoever, but doesn't sound too abstract and technical. You're a Christian and you're a healer. Being a Christian involves you in trying to be a certain kind of person, in trying to live out the Christian virtues. Now, a lot of those are virtues shared with other people, like truthfulness. Some are virtues that Christianity puts a particular emphasis on, like gentleness, patience, humility. And above all, clothing them all, as St. Paul says, is love, charity. So love is the shape that all the other virtues take when you're a Christian. And love that's given a human face, that's given a clarity by the life of Christ, who of course exercised his love towards the sick and the needy through compassion, through noticing and responding to their need. Being a healer, in order to be a healer, you need to have the relevant professional skills and professional judgment, very simply to do three things. It's so simple and so basic. To heal, to cure, that is, to provide care and comfort, and now increasingly important, to help people with prevention of sickness or maintenance of health, if you like. So just those three very simple things. You all know it, I just need to mention them. But I want to say, how do we keep our eye on the ball? So we're bringing together being a Christian and being a healer, or better way to put it, we're trying to be healers, you're trying to be healers, within the context of a Christian life. Healing is the Christian healer's way of loving, if you like. I'm deliberately sticking to very simple ideas and very simple language, because that makes it easy to check yourself whether you're living up to these ideals and whether you're keeping the eye on the ball. The more complicated and the more abstract and the more bureaucratic your language gets, the more difficult it is actually to know what you're doing and whether you're really living by that. And also it's easier to pass them on. And notice also that the things I'm talking about are very concrete, making people better, giving them care and comfort. I was struck by the seven principles at the front of the NHS Constitution, because they're so abstract that they could actually apply to anything. And you won't believe this, but when I drafted one of the drafts of this talk, I put a footnote in saying this would work for making chocolate biscuits. It's very important that whatever the principles are ones that really tell you what it is to do your job rather than somebody else's job, to live your vocation. In all this, I think we need to keep in mind the distinction between responsibility and accountability. There's a huge emphasis nowadays on accountability, and I think there's a lot of muddles about what that is. But primary to that is the question of responsibility. Who is the healer responsible for, and in what respect? And the answer, obviously, is for the patient in respect of their health. In an ideal world, accountability would always support that responsibility and not tempt you to be led away from it. And in order to try and develop that idea, I want to tell you the story about Peter the Piper. When I gave a draft of this to Liz over there, I said, it's a bit long, I'm going to have to cut some of it out. She said, well, make sure you keep in Peter the Piper. So here's Peter the Piper, and you can blame Liz if you don't like him. Peter the Piper is a musician. He loves music. He plays the pipes in order to play beautiful music and to have other people enjoy beautiful music. But Peter also lives in the real world. He's got to make a living. And he also knows how easy it is to have mixed motives, if you like, to be led away from the thing that you're really, really trying to do. So he hopes that every time he plays music, he's trying to play music as well as he possibly can. But there's various other people in Peter's life. there's Pauline. Now, Pauline is his patroness. We call her his employer nowadays, but I'm putting it in the past to make it a bit more romantic. And Pauline's a good patroness, so she doesn't try to affect his choice about music. She just lets him get on with it, trusts him, let him play the music as well as he can. Then he's got his friend Paul. Now, Paul is a really good musician. So when Peter plays in front of Paul, he's inspired. And he probably plays even better than he would anyway. And the third person in Peter's life is his beautiful girlfriend, Patricia. But the only difficulty with Patricia is she thinks she knows a lot about music, but she doesn't. And what Patricia likes is people playing music really, really fast. So when Peter's playing for her, he plays in a really flashy way. He spoils the tune in order to impress Patricia. If you were going to analyse that philosophically, you could say that there were three kinds of secondary goals. There's the secondary goal that Pauline sets for him. He's got the secondary goal to make the money, but Pauline doesn't affect his judgment. So it's a secondary goal that doesn't affect what you do. Then there's an inspiring secondary goal, Paul. He tries to play as well as he can. And then there's the distorting secondary goal, which is trying to impress Patricia. That makes him play in a way he knows isn't so good. How do you know whether the secondary goals are not affecting your judgment, inspiring your judgment, or distorting your judgment? And this is the key point I want to make. You know, because if you honestly explain to yourself why you did it that way, if it's a good secondary goal, then you'll go back to talking about the real purpose. So, if he's played for Paul, and somebody says to him, "Why did you play that phrase like that?" he'll say, "Well, I think slowing down at that point really brought out the emotion of the music here." Can you see how he talks about the music? So even though he's trying to impress Paul, what he talks about is the music. And again, if he's been playing for Patricia, it hasn't affected him. So he says, "Why did you play that like that?" Well, it's much more inspiring if you play louder in this bar. He's talking about the music. If you say to him, "Why did you play the way you played for Patricia?" he can't talk about the music. He has to say, "Well, I played it like that because Patricia likes it fast." Once the secondary goal has knocked you off course, you can only explain to yourself what you're doing by talking about the external goal and not about the thing that's your vocation. We can apply the same analysis to healthcare, to trying to live as a Christian healer, to trying to live out that vocation. Do the secondary goals affect, not affect, leave alone, or do they inspire, or do they distort what we're really trying to do? So, for example, we had some interesting discussions in one of the workshops about using the Liverpool Care Pathway. And people were saying, "Well, is it a good or a bad thing?" If somebody's using the Liverpool Care Pathway well, and you say, "Well, why did you ask the patient at this point whether or not they wanted to see a priest? Or why did you give that particular bit of pain control at this point?" If that's working as an inspiring goal, the answer won't be, "Because it says so in the Liverpool Care Pathway." The answer will be, "Because they needed the spiritual comfort. Because that was the right medical judgment to relieve their pain as much as possible at that point." Can you see? If the goal's inspiring you, then it'll push you back into talking about the things you're really meant to be talking about. If it's distorting your judgment, if it's some impossible target, "Why did you treat that patient rather than this patient when this one was dying?" in order to fulfill the targets, then you can see it's knocked you off the course you're meant to be focusing on. Keeping that focus is very, very difficult. It requires an education, a continuing education of all of us, of heart and mind and spirit. It's not just something that we can tick a box or get a qualification and try to do. Living the virtues is a lifelong exercise. And living the Christian virtues is a lifelong exercise that obviously involves prayer, reflection on the life of Christ, as well as constant examination of how we're succeeding, how we ought to be going forward, and so on. And the last little point I want to make is that we can't do this on our own. In order to support ourselves in mind, so that we understand what we ought to be doing, in heart, so that we encourage each other through the very difficult times that we're all facing, and in spirit, so we sustain that prayer, that scriptural reflection, prayer for each other in our work. In order to do that, we need communities. Obviously, we need the large community of the church. But I think more and more, we also need smaller communities and networks of support, not necessarily just with Christians, but including ones with other Christians and other Catholics. And those might be at work, those might be in our parishes, or wherever. And one little thing I'd like to say there is I just wonder whether that might be something that the local groups of the Catholic Medical Association might want to look at, thinking about how support in that way is provided. So all the time we're trying to internalise these virtues and these goals in the way that for Thomas More they were so completely internalised that he was never knocked off balance, because he always responded with the just act, with the response of integrity. And in the same way, we want, obviously, ourselves in our working lives, but also the people we're trying to pass this tradition on to be able to respond as Christian healers. So I just wanted to end by quoting a passage that you'll all know from Deuteronomy about the internalising of the word of the Lord, which I think is the sort of thing I'm trying to encourage. And these words which I command you today shall be upon your heart, and you shall teach them diligently to your children, and you shall talk of them when you sit in your house, and when you walk by the way, and when you lie down, and when you rise.